This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jon Krakauer writes about extremes. His best-selling book, Into Thin Air, was about the disastrous storm on Mount Everest in 1996. His bestseller, Into the Wild, was about a young man who set off for Alaska and died of starvation in the bush. Krakauer's new book is about religious extremes. He says that there is a dark side to religious devotion that is too often ignored or denied, a dark side which can be used to motivate people to be cruel or inhumane. Krakauer's new book, Under the Banner of Heaven, is about two brothers, Ron and Dan Lafferty, who murdered their youngest brother's wife and baby child, claiming that they were ordered to do so by God. Ron and Dan Lafferty are on the extreme end of Mormon fundamentalism. These fundamentalist communities practice polygamy, which is no longer sanctioned by the mainstream Mormon church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In fact, the LDS leadership insists these communities aren't part of the LDS church. Krakauer's book includes a history of the LDS and of the extremists who broke away. The Latter-day Saints is the Western Hemisphere's fastest-growing religion. I asked Krakauer why he wanted to examine the history of the Mormons and the extreme fringe of Mormon fundamentalism.
You know, I wanted to look at religious extremism, and the Mormon faith, perhaps unfortunately for the Mormons, seemed like a natural to me. First of all, I grew up in a small town in Oregon among Mormons. I mean, I had Mormon friends, close friends, and teachers and athletic coaches. So, and they'd invited me to their home. So as much as I knew about any religion, I knew about the LDS faith. And also, it's a distinctly American religion. I mean, this is, in some ways, the quintessential American religion. I mean, Islamic fundamentalism, we know about that, and some other fundamentalist faiths. But it seemed like it would sort of drive things home to realize that this isn't over in Afghanistan or Pakistan or somewhere. This is in America. So that was part of the reason I focused on Mormon fundamentalism and Mormon extremists. But also, the Mormon religion presents really tempting opportunities for a historian or a journalist, because the church was incorporated only 173 years ago. This is what's becoming a major world faith. I mean, it's going to be one of the big ones before long. And yet, it came into being in the age of the printing press and the affidavit, you know, in the bright lights of modernism. So the origins of this religion are really accessible. I mean, you can easily find affidavits from people who knew Joseph Smith when he was putting this religion together. So, you know, you can really see how a religion begins. And all of that was interesting to me. And I thought, it was clear to me that if I'm going to write about religion, this is the Mormon faith is the one to focus on.
Now, how do Mormon fundamentalist beliefs compare with the mainstream of the religion?
It's interesting. The modern Mormon church is very uncomfortable with the fundamentalists. And they point out correctly that they have, you know, they're two very distinct faiths. They say the Mormon fundamentalists aren't even Mormons, which, I mean, the Mormon fundamentalists say the main Mormon faith isn't even Mormons. Each claims to be the true Mormon church. And their origins, you know, their origins are in 1830 when the church began, and it was all one church. But one of the doctrines of Joseph Smith founded this religion. He was their guiding prophet, an amazing man. He's been called a religious genius, and he was certainly at least that. And one of his doctrines was the doctrine of plural marriage, as he called it, polygamy. He thought if you wanted to get into the highest level of the afterlife, the celestial kingdom, you had to have at least three wives. And he called this one of the most holy and important doctrines revealed to man on earth. It wasn't just a small thing. It was one of the cornerstones of the faith. So anyway, they went to what became Utah and practiced polygamy there. And this did not go over well with the rest of the country. Polygamy was seen as evil on a par or greater than slavery. So the United States government did everything in its power to eradicate polygamy in Utah territory. The United States actually declared war on Utah and sent this huge army to invade Utah. The Mormons resisted. They resisted for decades. The church finally had no choice. They had they had a gun to their head, in effect. And in 1890, the leader at the time, Wilford Woodruff, had a revelation from God in which God told him, now is not the time to practice polygamy anymore. And so the church, the main church, renounced it.
So now, when the church renounced polygamy, did people actually stop practicing it?
Well, no. Some did, but even the leaders of the church in secret, they still, you know, this was an important doctrine, and they weren't just going to give it up. So for the next 20 years, 15 or 20 years, even leaders of the church kept conducting polygamous marriages in secret. They dispatched colonies of Mormons to Canada and Mexico so if it was ever eradicated, that plural marriage would continue outside the borders. Finally, though, about 1920s, 1930s, within the church, Mormons themselves started saying, "This enough is enough. We're going to stop this." So there became this effort within the church to stamp out polygamy. And today, for example, the Mormon Church, the LDS Church, is probably the most aggressive attacker of polygamists, and they're the ones who crack down on it. But there was a hardcore of true believers who never really bought the abandonment of polygamy. So as the church became more mainstream and gave up polygamy, the fundamentalists broke off and continued to practice it.
So the fundamentalists split with the rest of the Mormons in part because they wanted to continue to practice polygamy, and they believed that polygamy was at the center of the Mormon faith, whereas the mainstream of the Mormon faith had renounced polygamy. But there were other beliefs that the fundamentalists practiced that the Mormons either didn't or no longer believed in. One of those is called blood atonement. What is that, and what is its origin?
Well, I have to, blood atonement, I should say, first of all, the modern Mormon church is very, very nervous when anyone talks about that. They claim it was just sort of an idea floated briefly and never really practiced. But the historical record indicates that, in fact, it was an important part of the Mormon faith in the mid-1800s. When you have to remember, the Mormon faith was extremely persecuted. They were hounded and driven out and, members killed. And at one point, Joseph Smith and later Brigham Young came up with this doctrine where, for the good of the bad person, the sinner, to save his soul, his blood must be spilled upon the ground and the smoke ascend up to heaven. So there was a sense of, it's basically some sins, some crimes are so egregious, the only way to atone for them is to sort of spill the blood of the sinner. And there was a lot of bloodshed in 19th century Mormondom, as it was in 19th century America. But the Mormons, violence was part of their culture because they were, it was inflicted on them. At first, Joseph Smith resisted it, but, as he was driven from place to place and armies were set upon him and they were massacred, he fought back. And eventually, the spilling of blood became codified in their doctrines, and blood atonement was part of that.
Now, how is that practiced by Mormon fundamentalists? What is their belief about the meaning of blood atonement?
Well, the same meaning. Mormon fundamentalists today would also deny that they practice such a thing, but, I've received tapes of sermons from Mormon fundamentalists, and in fact, it is still advocated where, if some fundamentalist does something so terrible, like marries a black person, say, or practices homosexuality, for his own good, his blood needs to be spilled upon the ground. Or if, there's any number of perceived sins that can warrant this. So, it's not an accident that Utah is still, if you're convicted of murder in Utah, you have a choice of execution, either lethal injection or the firing squad. I mean, the firing squad is still, it's still there in Utah, and many people, not just me, think that's an artifact of the doctrine of blood atonement.
Now, your book not only looks at the history of the Mormon religion and the history of Mormon fundamentalism, it examines one particular murder story where two brothers who were Mormon fundamentalists killed one of their sisters-in-law and her infant, her baby. The brothers were Ron and Dan Lafferty, and they had wanted their whole family to follow their brand of religion, their brand of Mormon fundamentalism, and they got much of their family to go along with that, but not one of their sisters-in-law, not Brenda Lafferty. Why didn't she want to go along with that faith?
Both Ron and Dan were raised as conventional Mormons, very devout. As Dan said, he was 110%er. He did everything 110% because he was so religious. And And when he was a young adult, he learned, you know, the modern church hides the fact that polygamy was so important, and he happened to learn about it at a you know, one Sunday in a Mormon ward house, a Mormon church, and he was fascinated, and once he started reading about it, he became a fundamentalist. He became a polygamist. He quickly converted his five brothers to that, and these brothers began enforcing this 19th century lifestyle on their wives. You know, they started practicing polygamy. They did things like, you know, no books or magazines are allowed in the house. They turned off the gas and electricity. It made life tough for the wives. And all of the wives sort of were cowed into going along with this, except for one, the youngest wife, Brenda Wright Lafferty, married to the youngest Lafferty brother, Alan. And she was, you know, she was a devout Mormon raised in Idaho, a beauty queen. She was runner-up in the Miss Twin Falls pageant. Very smart. She'd gone to Brigham Young University, had a nascent career in broadcasting. She was very smart, very articulate, and she saw trouble here. And so she had the wherewithal, she had the smarts to stand up to the Lafferty brothers. She could argue scripture with them as well, you know, at least as well as they could. She could hold her own. You know, the other wives turned to her out of desperation. You know, can you help us? Can you help us? And this very courageous young woman agreed to help them. So, in particular, Ron, the oldest Lafferty brother, his wife was made miserable by this. And once, when Ron announced his plans to start marrying off their daughters into polygamous marriages, she freaked out and got very frightened. And Brenda, this young woman, helped Diana, Ron's wife, flee the marriage and take her kids and go to Florida. And Ron was very upset by this, and he blamed Brenda for you know, the fact that he lost his wife.
Now, the two brothers who committed the murder, Dan and Ron Lafferty, said that a religious vision figured into their motive for the murder. What kind of religious vision did they have?
Well, the Mormon Church was founded on the principle that each of the faithful can talk directly to God. This is one of the things that made the church so appealing, as Joseph Smith got rid of the middleman. Everyone talks directly to God. You don't have to go through a priest. You don't have to go through anybody. This led to trouble because soon, you know, some of Joseph's rivals within the church said, well, God told me this. He told me that I'm better than you, and so on. So it got moderated somewhat. But anyway, Ron and Dan Lafferty, once they became fundamentalist Mormons, they embraced this idea of personal revelation wholeheartedly, and they were part of this school that taught the art of personal revelation. And soon after joining this school, not long after Ron's wife left him, God began talking to Ron. And one of the things he said was that your sister-in-law, Brenda Lafferty, the woman who told your wife to leave, needs to be removed, and so does her 15-month-old baby daughter, Erica. Now, this is a pretty serious thing. It was clear to all involved that by removed, he meant that God was saying this woman needs to be killed and her baby needs to be killed. So Ron Lafferty got this revelation. He told Dan about it, and Dan said, wow, that's pretty serious. You better make sure it's true. So they pondered it and decided it was true. Now, Dan had nothing against Brenda or Erica, but, you know, he didn't want to disobey God. You don't disobey God lightly. Ron's motives can be argued, but Dan is a true believer, a zealot, and they pondered this and decided that God meant Dan to do the dirty work. Ron was the mouth of God. Dan was the arm of God. So it was, you know, this is something they needed to do, was to remove Brenda Lafferty and her baby girl, which is shocking and appalling, but that's what these true believers believed.
And what method did they use to actually commit the murders?
They used knives. They Dan Lafferty used a knife to cut the throats of this woman and her baby in an incredibly brutal manner. I mean, you know, spilling copious amounts of their blood, totally cold, in a cold-blooded fashion. You know, and when Dan told me about how he did it, I mean, he feels absolutely no remorse for this. You know, this is what, in 1984 that he committed these murders, so it's 19 years later. He feels no remorse for the deed, and he says, why should I? I was doing God's will. He's convinced of it. So when he told me about it, I mean, he was telling me in sort of this calm, measured tone of voice, like, yeah. It was almost like he was describing a trip to the grocery store. It was just sort of matter of fact, and it was absolutely chilling because of it.
He told you that he explained to the baby as he was killing her that this was God's will.
Right. He you know, the baby, this 15-month-old baby standing in the crib, he walks into a room, she sees him, recognizes him, gurgles, smiles, and he says, I don't know what this is about. Perhaps God will explain it to us in heaven one day. I'm sort of sorry. And then he cut her throat and let her bleed to death in her crib. Then he went back to the mother who was unconscious on the floor and cut her throat and left. And the revelation included killing two more people. So then they left and went to attempt to kill these other people, which they never did for complicated reasons. But then the brothers, left the state and were arrested a few weeks later in Nevada and sent to prison and underwent very interesting trials.
You know, now the judge of the trial, who also presided over the trial of Gary Gilmore, said, "In my 12 years as a judge, I have never presided over a trial of such a cruel, heinous, pointless, and senseless crime as the murders of Brenda and Erica Lafferty, nor have I seen an accused who had so little remorse or feeling." Now, the defense in this case made the argument that the brothers were mentally deranged. And why did they use that as the defense?
Well, it's a very complicated defense, actually, because, if you're insane, you can't be put to death, even in Utah. But the state had this difficult task of proving, no, they're not insane. They're mentally competent. They're just religious fanatics. So it raised all these really interesting questions, like if you talk to God, does that mean you're crazy? And if you're crazy if you talk to God, then anyone who prays and talks to God is crazy. In effect, anyone who's religious is crazy. So it was treading on this really sort of dangerous ground and made for a very interesting trial. In the end, both brothers were found to be mentally competent. Both were found guilty. Ron was sentenced to death, the older brother who got the revelations. Dan, the person who actually carried the murders out, received a life sentence because two of the jurors couldn't agree to on the death penalty. So Ron is scheduled to be executed. You know, his appeal is running out. He's sort of gone through all the avenues, and he will probably be executed within a year or two at most. Dan got a life sentence, and he will spend the rest of his life behind bars, but he will not be executed.
Now, do you know how the brothers felt about their own lawyers defending them by saying that they were mentally deranged? Because they believed that they had a religious vision that they were following. They didn't believe they were mentally deranged.
Right. And I can't speak for Ron. He wouldn't talk to me. He's still in prison. So I don't know about him. Some of the prosecutors think he is sort of faking his religious devotion and was faking his apparent craziness. Dan, who I've corresponded with a lot and spoken to intensely, I'm convinced he's not crazy. I mean, and he didn't want, neither of the brothers wanted to be portrayed as crazy. They were insulted by this. They said, "We're not crazy. You know, we're sane as any religious person. We just believe and we're just doing what God told us. It's all part of God's plan. You know, Jesus is coming back soon and this is all part of that plan." So they didn't want to be portrayed as crazy. And that sort of helped contribute to their conviction because their lawyers were sort of hamstrung. Witnesses that would have testified they were crazy weren't allowed to, and so forth.
Now, when you interviewed Dan Lafferty, one of the two brothers behind this double murder, did he still maintain his Mormon fundamentalist faith?
Well, Dan Lafferty now has been in prison. I guess he entered prison in 1985, so it's been almost, I don't know, 18 years or something. And his views have evolved. He no longer believes in polygamy. He no longer considers himself a Mormon fundamentalist. He still thinks what he did was, you know, the work of God. He still feels no regret. But now he sort of sees it all as part of God's plan. He thinks God has designated him to be Elijah. In the Bible, in Christian theology, Elijah is the sort of the forerunner for Jesus. He's the one that announces that Jesus is coming back. He announces the second coming. And Dan is utterly convinced that he is Elijah. It's his role. So he sort of moved beyond Mormon fundamentalism and now is this more fundamentalist Christian belief. I mean, his theology is really complicated, but that's basically where he is. And he thinks this book and the publicity he's received is all part of God's plan, you know, because he's Elijah and he needs to get attention so he can tell the world when Jesus is coming back.
Does Dan still believe in the vision that motivated he and his brother to commit the double murder?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I grilled him hard, you know, and he has no doubts. And I said, well, I said, look, Dan, what do you think of Osama bin Laden? He said, oh, he's an asshole, you know. What they did was terrible. And I said, well, what's the difference between Osama and you? God told both of you to do these things. And it's the one time he sort of a flicker of doubt crossed his face. And then he came back and said, well, basically, because I'm right and Osama is wrong, and which is sort of the defense all fundamentalists, all religious zealots use, is when it comes down to it, you know, faith is not a rational thing. It can't be, their beliefs can't be proven rationally. It's just, I know this is true because God told me. And that's Dan's defense, that, you know, Osama was listening to a false God and I'm not. And he still believes that utterly. And there's no way to shake that faith, which is a really scary thing to me because, you know, as far as I can tell, religious devotion is on the rise in this country. We need more faith, you know, faith-based this, faith-based that. I don't see that as necessarily positive development. I think faith is great, and it's inevitable in any case. It'll always be with us, but it needs to be tempered by some sort of critical thought, or you end up with tragic consequences.
It seems to me it must be a real burden, in a way, a grave responsibility to write about a religion in a critical way, particularly when you're not a member of that religion, because it's so much easier to get things wrong when you're not an insider. And I'm just wondering about how you handled that responsibility and if you felt uncomfortable talking about the extreme part of the Mormon faith. Sure. and in a pretty non-flattering way.
Yeah, no, I do take that responsibility very seriously, and I tried to be very clear in this book to distinguish between Mormons and Mormon fundamentalists. But, I mean, this is a church that, you know, that its own histories have been so sanitized that it warrants a critical history. I mean, their histories are out there. People can read theirs. They can read mine. There's many good histories of the Mormon church. I mean, and the church isn't just off in a corner by itself practicing its faith. It is very aggressively trying to convert the world. I mean, they have 60,000 missionaries out roaming the world at any one time. They assert that they are the world's one true church and try to convince people of that. So if you're going to make that kind of assertion, you can't complain, it seems to me, when people challenge that assertion. And the church is increasingly powerful. I mean, that you can't just say, oh, it's a religion, that we should leave them alone to practice as they see fit. I mean, I grew up with Mormons. I admire so much about their culture, their values. Many of us would do well to adopt their values. But it doesn't mean they are beyond criticism. I think many saints, as Mormons call themselves, will read this book and see that it isn't an attack on Mormonism. It's not even an attack on religion. It just raises questions. I mean, I understand the impulse. I envy that religious impulse and that sense of belief. But it just has escaped me. So I would take issue with those who characterize this book as an attack on religion in general and Mormonism in particular.
Now, a lot of our listeners will know your bestseller, Into Thin Air, which was your documentation of the storm on Mount Everest that killed many of the climbers. You're one of the people who was on the mountain and survived the storm. A lot of people in your situation, I think, would have found themselves becoming either more religious or would have discovered a faith for the first time. I mean, that just often happens to people who are in these near-death, life-changing situations. Did you ever have a moment like that where you thought maybe this was going to open the door to a newfound faith?
I was probably more... I mean, what happened on Everest and the terrible things and the loss of friends left me sort of more inclined to believe there is no God, there is no justice. But, as I confess in the afterword in this book, that there have been many moments when I've been terrified or despairing or moments when I see something of such incredible beauty that I'm awestruck, where I find myself praying involuntarily. You know, the old, there's no atheists in foxholes. I'm sort of proof of that. I don't say there is no God. I say I don't know if there's God. And all the religions I've studied, some with the hope that they would convince me, have left me with a bad feeling because so many of them say theirs is the only answer, theirs is the only faith. So that's why I'm put off by so much religion seems political and to have other agendas and simply explaining eternity or why we are here. I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm still questing. I'm a spiritual person. I'm not this cold rationalist who thinks, you know, there's no meaning to life. It's just this cosmic accident. I just don't know what that meaning is. And this book was an attempt, a good faith, honest attempt on my part to explore the meaning of existence and explore religious belief.
John Krakauer is the author of the new book, Under the Banner of Heaven. It's about two brothers, Mormon fundamentalists, who murdered their younger brother's wife and child, claiming they were ordered to do so by God. The book also examines the history of the Mormon Church and the fundamentalist extremists who broke away.